Have we seen immediate success? Not yet, but I'm very confident that we're on the right track, and we're working on programs that'll save people's lives every day.
Well, that should be the focus, right, in saving lives. And it's a real challenge right now with this overdose crisis we're going through. So that was the premier this morning. When asked about that, the Alberta government is taking a different approach than maybe other provinces, the Alberta model, as she calls it. But we're still seeing very high levels of opioid overdose deaths in Alberta. So is that approach working? I think when it comes to this issue, we need to be open-minded when it comes to evidence, to maybe put preconceived notions aside, to understand what's going on and how best to tackle it. But there are obviously different approaches to this and different opinions on this, and maybe, unfortunately, kind of a polarized conversation around all of this. And I don't know that that's helpful. But I mean, the good news is that there is a lot of focus on this issue. There's actually a couple of different events happening in Calgary this week, taking a look at this issue from different perspectives. One is called the National Recovery Capital Conference. The other is Community Conversations, Drug Policy Alternatives for Alberta. Different events, different kinds of focus, but the one common thread was going to be our next guest, who was actually set to speak at both of these events. So there's kind of a story here, I guess, around why one of those invitations was rescinded. But this is somebody who's got a lot of insight and really unique perspective on issues around addiction and recovery. Guy Felicella is a former addict himself, is a recovery and harm reduction expert, much more at his website, guyfelicella.com. And as mentioned, he's here in Calgary this week and is on the line with us here this afternoon. Guys, so great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So the point I made, the Alberta government's making new announcements about focusing on recovery and addiction. We're seeing a real focus in other parts of the country. Are we making progress? Is it a good thing that these issues seem to be front and center right now?
Yeah, it's always a good thing when you're, looking at ways and means to address the toxic drug crisis. That part is noted, and I think recovery aspects behind that is a great model for people who are seeking recovery. I don't have any problem with I'm a supporter of recovery, but I'm also a supporter of harm reduction, and I know the road is a long process, and many people go into recovery treatment and then complete and then leave and then go use again for the toxic drug supply on the street, sadly overdose. And what I've noticed with the province of Alberta is it doesn't have a big enough harm reduction safety net underneath that. So there's some concerns for sure. And obviously the increase in overdose deaths in 2023 from 2022 were running at about 18% right now, probably higher when you get your relief for the end of 2023. So, yeah, it's sad circumstances for sure.
It is. As it says right there on your website, you say, I wouldn't be alive today without harm reduction. I wouldn't have the life that I have today without recovery. We need both. But does it feel like the debate's become polarized in the sense that it seems to be one or the other?
100%. This division that's in our society is been created by, structural laws and policies, but what it does is it fuels a population of people like us for how we view things. And, like I said, how many times I went through treatment and left, and if there wasn't the proper harm reduction services, I died six times. And if there wasn't people and supervised consumption sites and other harm reduction outreach programs, I mean, I just wouldn't have been able to recovery. And, take it from a guy that has 11 years of sobriety right now.
Yeah.
You need to have both. And unfortunately, Alberta has kind of gone in with this Alberta model all in on that and really neglected the harm reduction safety net underneath it. And it's going to cause, sadly, more deaths because of it.
Well, tell us more about your story. I think people have a hard time understanding, the nature of addiction or how people fall into that or the struggles they go through. And I know every individual's situation is different. But tell us a bit more about, what you went through and how you came out on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, I had a challenging life. I, struggled with undiagnosed learning disabilities, a lot of trauma as a child, verbal abuse, physical abuse, it really impacted my life. I became using drugs at 12 years old, really fell into the downtown east side, for decades, had so many other issues going on behind the scenes, you know, trying to bury the pain. And, you know, always at that time as well, you know, for 31 years, I was trying to figure it out. I just, you know, every time this is the thing, I was good at getting sober. I wasn't good at staying sober. And a lot of it was not being dealt with in recovery and treatment facilities, such as the trauma that I was feeling. It's like, you know, you go into treatment and recovery and your life does get better in the sense that I had a bed or I had a place to live, I had some food, but how I felt about myself as a person was really challenging. And, you know, that's what kept leading me back to the substances. And obviously there's a lot of societal issues in our society as well. You know, I was homeless, couldn't get housing, you know, employment was hard, criminal record in and out of the prison system for, you know, the majority of my life. And it just got to a place. You know, harm reduction really kept me alive for all those years. I was always trying, but, you know, and there's a lot of people I'm sure that are trying in Alberta. They're just not getting the outcome that they're looking for. But we don't celebrate people trying, and there is a lot of people trying to figure it out.
Well, it's the thing. It's not easy. You know, it's a long process, and that's once you get in. I mean, I think there's still concern about just the availability of addiction treatment, or just, you know, that there's that long-term commitment from the system to be there every step of the way. Are we still falling short in that respect?
Oh, 100%. Like, big time. Everybody is, though. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you can't just go into the front door of a treatment facility, stay there a year, walk out the back, and, you know, you have this fantastic, amazing life. There's a lot of issues, especially with a lot of people who don't have housing. What happens after a year in treatment? You go back to being homeless, living in a shelter. Who hires you because you have a criminal record? There's so many complex issues. And I think sometimes what sounds good to people is the simplicity of, like, go to treatment, get off drugs. Sounds like a great idea, and public loves it. But it's much harder than that, much more complex than that. And you're dealing with human beings who have been, you know, stigmatized and dehumanized for most of their lives that struggle with addiction. You know, we just need to do better and be better as people. And, you know, the aspect, the back end of treatment is really the thing that I focus on. And it's really doesn't exist. You know, people need purpose and employment and housing. And so companies in Alberta, all across Canada, need to start hiring people so that people have or find purpose in their lives. Because without it, it's just, you just need to go back to what you're familiar with.
Right. And, you know, I think, you know, back to the point about how some people see this as one or the other, because, you know, harm reduction is not meant to replace recovery. I think some people maybe see it as an obstacle to recovery, the idea that harm reduction is, you know, just perpetuating an addiction. What do you say to that?
Yeah, that's like the false narrative. You know, what perpetuated my addiction is the isolation and loneliness that I felt as a person. That was really what killed me, you know, and going to harm reduction services and building connections with people there. This is the thing. It's like, you know, I could have had numerous times trying and was trying to access and getting into treatment and recovery. I would go and stay sober for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. It took me 26 years to get 1 year of sobriety. And then I went out and relapsed again and, you know, was brought back to life six times. So when you actually think about it, you know, I was always trying. Like I said, there's so many people trying to access treatment. It's just not as easy as people like to make it sound. And it's a chronic relapsing condition. That means people don't just go into recovery and get better. There's usually multiple relapses for the majority of people who enter treatment. And then if there's no harm reduction services and access to the possibility of safer substances, and guess what happens is people go back to that toxic drug supply used alone, and then they don't recover anyway. So we just really have to do both. As much as Alberta is doing on the recovery side, they really need to do just as much on the harm reduction side. Otherwise, you're just going to put people into treatment, and then when they relapse and use again, the risk is high for death.
So you're here in Alberta, you're here in Calgary this week, and, you know, looking to share your experience, share your insight with as wide an audience as possible. You are set to speak at a couple of different events happening here this week, but one of those invitations, as we noted, got rescinded. So give us the backstory on this.
Yeah, I was never speaking at the Recovery Capital Conference. I was actually just going there for work.
Okay.
I work for the health authority. And so I was coming to, I'm always, you know, learning and listening to different conferences. And this other community engagement group. One of the moms reached out to me and told me about the people who are struggling in Alberta that work in the harm reduction and the front lines and witnessing the amount of lives lost and just a really tough time for them. And they asked if I would come and speak. And I said, sure, I can help you guys out. I'd do that. I'm about supporting and helping people. And apparently that there's somebody that at this harm reduction community event that the Alberta government and the Last Door organizers don't like. So they rescinded my attendance. And so I'm banned from the Recovery Capital Conference because of it. And I'm a person with lived experience, abstinence-based recovery, works in the recovery sector, help people get into treatment, and I'm barred from a recovery event, but the harm reduction event that knows that I'm attending a recovery event welcomed me in to come, you know. So it's just a lot about the organizers in Alberta more than it says about me. It's unfortunate, and I was actually taken back and very saddened by that as well.
And it's weird because it's, you know, obviously not accusing you of anything. The idea that you might be at a same conference or sharing a stage with somebody else that they don't like. I mean, what does that have to do with you? That's what's so strange about it.
It doesn't. And that, like I said, it really kind of shows where they're at. I'm about helping people. You know, this is the thing. I don't support harm reduction over recovery or recovery over harm reduction. I support people. And, you know, for me, that's what it's always been about. And, you know, I understand how long this takes for people. And so what I don't want is people to die. But unfortunately for the Recovery Capital Conference, I'm not allowed to attend. And so, I'll do other things. But the amount of people who had reached out across the country in shock and were saddened and frustrated and angry that I, of all people, wouldn't be allowed at this conference. And so they're coming into Alberta, and we're actually going to be hanging out as well. So, you know, I'm still getting the full effect of hanging out with my friends and colleagues from across the country while helping some other people that are really struggling working the front lines. So for me, it's a win-win.
Well, as you posted on social media, you say, if we're going to solve this terrible crisis, we must listen to each other and find the places we align. We're not there yet, are we?
Absolutely not. No, it's tremendously unfortunate. We've created this division, and a lot of it is created through the politicalization of, you know, governments that have been doing this. So it's just truly... You know, the one thing is that the sad part of all of this, and I've witnessed this with the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 90s in Vancouver, the sad part of all of this is that the people who are struggling suffer further because of it. It's, you know, unfortunately, people have to sit in the room and have differences of opinions and be able to voice those opinions and not be shut down. This is really somewhat of a censorship of me coming to the conference to not ask any questions. Or, you know, I guess Alberta is just pushing this model at full throttle. And if anybody tries to stand up against it, they'll just, you know, tell you that, no, they don't want to hear it. So it's unfortunate. Yeah. But
And the ironic part of it is, I mean, you're someone who's benefited from recovery, who can speak to, the impact of recovery. And they don't want to hear that story. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know what? I do talks globally. I educate high school kids on not following down the same path that I did, on recovery, on harm reduction, on public health approaches. You know, it really says a lot about the conference organizers and the Alberta government. They could rescind that immediately and allow me to come, but for whatever reason, at this point in time, I'm not welcome there. And so, you know, hey, and the good thing is that so many people that are attending that conference are in support of me. And the other thing that I thought about as well is that there's many people attending that conference that support harm reduction services. So are they going to be barred too as well? It's really interesting, and it's too bad. But, to me, it's like, you know, I just, you know, like things happen for a reason. And, I'm content with that. That's one thing I've learned in my recovery, that you just be content and understand that it's not about me. It says more about them.
Well, we'll leave it there. Guy, we really do appreciate you making some time for us here today. Thanks for sharing your story and your insight, and enjoy your time here in Calgary.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
All the best, Guy. Take care. That's Guy Felicella. He's a former addict himself, a recovery and harm reduction expert, who was mentioned is here in Calgary this week, is speaking at, I guess, just one conference now. So a bit of an unfortunate episode there. Much more at his website, guyfelicella.com. That's F-E-L-I-C-E-L-L-A. I think he's an important voice in all of this. I don't think it has to be one or the other. And we seem so polarized now in this conversation. Like, it seems to me harm reduction and recovery are almost targeting two separate things. Harm reduction is about keeping people alive, and recovery is about getting their life back together. Now, look, I think there's been a lot of frustration aimed at the mayor and at City Hall. And one of those issues has certainly been in some of the recent property tax increases that Calgary homeowners have been saddled with, and a pretty big one coming this year. It's an ongoing conversation around this, though. Like, why is it that cities only have to rely on property taxes when it comes to revenue, or basically transfers from other levels of government? Cities don't really have any other revenue tools. Should that be different? Could that be different? There's an interesting new report out from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, what they call a modest proposal, a plan to give municipalities access to personal income taxes. So we pay income taxes to the federal government, we pay income taxes to the provincial government. What about the idea of a third level of government there? Now, what this study looks at specifically is the idea of a 1% municipal income tax on incomes over $246,000. Just off that, they say, for example, the city of Calgary could raise $67 million. Is just this just more tax on top of what's already there? Is this maybe something that could replace or reduce the reliance on property taxes? Is one preferable to the other? Well, joining us for some further thoughts on this study, which, by the way, you can read at policyalternatives.ca, is David McDonald. He is a senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and author of this report. David, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
I mean, it's generally the same for municipalities across the country, whether it's Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg, Toronto, that they're pretty much entirely reliant on property taxes when it comes to revenue?
Yeah, that's a pretty broad statement, but it's generally true. There are some provinces, actually, that themselves charge a big portion of property taxes and keep it themselves provincially. But it is the main source of revenue for cities across the country.
And why is that? Do we know?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, historically speaking, if you go back to pre-World War II, cities commonly actually had corporate income taxes, personal income taxes, and property taxes. During the war effort, the corporate and personal income taxes were canceled municipally and were moved up to the federal and provincial levels, but cities kept property taxes. And that's remained the case ever since. And so when we look at it today, we say, oh, you know, cities have property taxes. That's their main source of revenue. It wasn't always the case, but that is the case today. And so cities become very reliant on a property base that the way that we've designed it does not expand with economic growth and does not expand with inflation. And so you get this debate every year in City Hall in Calgary, but in every City Hall across the country, you have to increase property taxes 1%, 3%, 5%. What you never see is you never see that debate provincially, because the provinces rely on income taxes, and that is a tax base that does expand with economic growth and inflation, and you don't have to change the rate every year. And so you don't see this, oh, do we have to increase income taxes 1%, 5%? That's not a debate that happens provincially or federally. That's not how those tax bases work.
So would you argue that it would be preferable if municipalities could rely on that sort of revenue?
Well, I mean, from the city's perspective, it would be preferable if the province just sent them more money. But that's not what's happening. And right. So this is one of the issues. Potentially, this is a second best solution for the cities, is they need the revenue, they need the income to provide the services, but they don't have access to it. So income taxes is an interesting option in that it's a new tax base. It expands with economic growth. So when folks do well, when inflation, you know, goes up, the revenue from that as a tax base goes up as well. That's not what happens with property taxes.
Right.
And it provides options for cities. So, I don't necessarily, it doesn't have to be prescriptive that the city has to do it at 1% for incomes over 250,000. These are the sort of wealthiest Canadians. Maybe a city wants a broader tax that goes to the middle class as well, but raises a lot more money. Maybe it's for new services. You know, maybe they want to go on a boom of filling potholes in the city, but maybe it's for a tax swap. So maybe what they want to do is they want to decrease property taxes, but levy a new 1% tax for the wealthiest in Calgary, for instance, and play the long game, which is you decrease property taxes now, but you're actually better off 5 years from now because income taxes grow with economic growth, whereas property taxes don't. So it's not so much that we should do, that any city should do anything specific with it, but that it provides a lot more interesting options for what cities could do if they'd access, which they don't presently.
Right. And they're really not able to. I mean, I think that's part of the challenge here is, I guess, would this mean provincial governments would have to change their legislation with the federal government? Because this would, I would assume, involve Revenue Canada. Maybe the federal government needs to be involved. How would we get there if cities wanted to?
Yeah, so the Canada Revenue Agency already collects all personal income taxes, not only for the federal government, but all the provincial governments as well. Mm-hmm. That when you fill your taxes, you do it with the CRA, and then the CRA sends a check to your provincial government. The CRA could also open up that facility for cities. So if you live within the city boundaries, they know where you live, you have to file down your income taxes, and they collect an extra 1% on people making over $250,000 or something and send that back to the cities. CRA already applies taxes differently depending on which city you're in and whether that city has bylaws against certain types of housing arrangements. And so the CRA already does that to some degree. The provinces, though, interestingly, don't have to be involved in that per se, but it's wise for you to get an agreement in advance. The reason why I say that is the provinces could veto that arrangement, which is to say a direct financial agreement between the federal government and the city. That actually is what happens in Quebec. So Quebec already has enacted that veto where the federal government cannot sign agreements directly with the cities. Alberta, the provincial government seems interested in this. They don't have it yet. They haven't instituted that veto yet, but they could. And so you would certainly want them to sort of agree in advance they're going to stay out of the way. And then you leave it up to cities to the idea of proposing this paper is you give them the basic some basic criteria. So, you know, what percentage change do they want to make and which ones of the major federal brackets, just so it's very similar to the federal systems. There aren't a lot of changes. So, you know, you could do incomes over 50,000, which is the second bracket. You'd make more money that way, but it would apply to people in the middle class. You could focus it more towards the higher end, people making over 250,000. You wouldn't make as much money, but it's much more targeted. And so you can fiddle around with income taxes and target them much more specifically than you can property taxes. Property taxes, everybody in the city pay the same rate, which is the mill rate. Income taxes don't work that way. You can be much more specific.
Is this advocating then that this would be sort of specifically targeted to personal income taxes? Does this potentially open the door then to municipal corporate income taxes or municipal consumption / sales taxes?
Well, this is specific to personal income taxes. Corporate income taxes, interestingly, was a power cities used to have pre-World War II. It would be much more difficult today to institute that. And the reason why is because companies don't operate very specifically in cities anymore. They're going to have operations across the country. And so we have a national system to deal with that between the provinces. You can't just sort of declare all your income in the low province and, province can't become kind of a tax haven in that sense. But the way it's disclosed right now, it'd be difficult to do that at the city basis. When it comes to a sales tax, this is traditionally actually one of the things cities have advocated for is a city-level sales tax. That is something, I suppose, that the cities could advocate for. One of the issues with sales taxes that we've learned is that they hit lower-income folks hardest insofar as lower-income folks spend all their money. They don't save anything. They spend everything and therefore pay sales tax on everything. And so sales tax, the proportion of their income tends to be higher. So you'd want some sort of low-income offset, which now becomes more complicated at the city level. The other thing, too, is that everybody who pays sales tax pays it at the same rate, and there's no difference. You can't specify high-income, low-income, mid-income the way you can with income taxes. So there are some differences there, although this paper proposes a personal income tax.
I think the challenge for municipalities, too, is, you know, with federal taxes, I mean, you know, most Canadians live and work in Canada. Most Canadians also live and work in their respective provinces. When it comes to cities, that's a bit more of a challenge, right? Folks can live in Richmond and work in Vancouver. Folks can live in Okotoks and work in Calgary. Folks can, you know, live in Vaughan and work in Toronto. These kinds of challenges. And, you know, it's easy for people to move as well. So what about that as a potential obstacle to this as an efficient policy?
Yeah, I mean, they can move anyway. And so if you take a look at the city of Toronto, which is potentially the most dense area in terms of having, you know, a fair amount of different cities, they all have different tax rates. I mean, there isn't a common tax rate across the GTA. And that is an area where you could plausibly live, you know, probably one end to the other. You might, you know, change your commute and stuff, but it's plausible. And there's a huge range of tax rates. Between the lowest and the highest city, the tax rate is double. If you take a look at the amount that people are paying on the average house price, between the lowest amount they're paying versus the highest amount that they're paying in the GTA, it's about a 60% difference. So a huge difference in a very small area in what people pay in property taxes. And so if you're an economist and that's all you cared about is you want to pay the lowest tax rate, you could do that if you wanted to. The trouble is that a lot of people don't seek out the place that has the lowest tax rate. They seek out the place that's the best place to live. So what's the place with the best services, that has the best roads, that has the best snow clearing and that sort of thing? Not the taxes pay for. They pay for services. And so this is, you know, this is the other side of the tax equation, is it's not just about who has the lowest taxes. It's who does the most with them to deliver the best services. And in the GTA, it's not as if sort of the highest tax areas like Oakville, for instance, empty out and they go to the lowest tax areas, which interestingly actually is the city of Toronto. That's not actually what's happening. People move to the services that they want. Like they like Oakville. They're not going to move out of Oakville, even though they actually pay a lot of tax living in Oakville.
Interesting idea. Much more. It's policyalternatives.ca. David, thanks so much for joining us here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All the best. David McDonald is a senior economist at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, author of this report on how municipalities could have access to personal income taxes and what that would look like. I think if it was a straight-up choice, do you prefer the status quo, the property taxes, the annual increases, or this? You know, you might get some interesting, I think, conversation going. And maybe people might like the idea of swapping one for the other. I think the fear is, and usually is in these kinds of conversations, is that you end up getting the worst of both worlds. You end up with both. You're still paying the property taxes. Now, all of a sudden, there's some new income tax that goes to cities, too. It just feels like it would add to the tax burden. I think that we see that with the debate around the idea of a PST in Alberta. The idea, if there was a provincial sales tax and income taxes came down, sure, okay, that might be all right. But I think the fear is you're just going to get both. Just working to track down our next guest here, a former Calgarian, in fact, who's now at Harvard University with the Center on Astrophysics, part of this research into better understanding the supermassive black hole that lies at the center of our galaxy. We've got a new image of this black hole that's really quite something. We're also learning more about it. So Sagittarius A is what we call this black hole at the heart of our galaxy. It has a mass around 4 million times that of the sun. So you think about our sun, how big it is, planets that orbit it, the gravitational pull it has. So imagine 4.3 million suns. That's how powerful this black hole is. But here's what's mind-blowing. So as big as that one is, there's another one we found previously in galaxy M87. And the funny thing is that it was easier to find this black hole and look at this black hole because of how huge it is. So the one in our galaxy represents about 4 million suns. This one represents about 6.5 billion suns. So that's quite a monster. Anyway, so some interesting research around this black hole in our galaxy and these new images, too, which are pretty cool. Which, I mean, we can't show you on the radio, unfortunately, but you just have to take our word for it. Anyway, so we'll get to that in a few minutes. We got him. Oh, perfect. Okay. Dr. Paul Tita, as mentioned, grew up right here in Calgary, as a matter of fact. He's a contributor to the paper that was published this week. He's with the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard and Smithsonian postdoctoral fellow, and also with the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. Paul, so good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk about the recent results.
Well, I find all this stuff fascinating too, right? And just not even being able to kind of figure out where these black holes exist, but to be able to kind of see them, basically. So this image that was released of this Sagittarius A, I guess we call it. Tell us a bit more about how you go about, producing an image like this.
Well, it's really interesting. It's a very big black hole, about 4.3 million times the mass of our sun, but it's so far away that it's tiny on the sky. I guess I'm from Calgary, so and Canadian, so it'd be kind of like trying to see a dime on the moon or watching a game of hockey on the moon from your house. So to actually make that work, you basically have to turn the entire Earth into a telescope, and we do this by placing a bunch of radio dishes across the planet and using software to kind of tie them all together, turning the entire Earth into something that is able to resolve or produce these images.
And that's the Event Horizon Telescope?
Yeah, that's the Event Horizon Telescope.
So it's interesting to me, and I was reading, so, whereas this black hole has a mass of around 4 million times that of our sun, there's another one that lurks in a different galaxy that actually, as I understand, it's been easier to monitor because of how massive it is. It represents about 6.5 billion suns.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so the one in the center of our galaxy is around 4 million, and the other one's 6 billion. But the trick with the 6 billion one is it's also about 1,000 times farther from us. So even though it's a lot bigger, when we look at it at the sky, it's about the same size to the telescope.
And so part of what you discovered here, I guess, are some similarities between these black holes.
Yeah, it's actually one of the most interesting things because a priori, or before we actually took these pictures, I think there was a lot of expectations that they may look very different. The original picture that we took of the other black hole, M87, has a very large and prominent jet that we've known about for close to 100 years. Mm-hmm. And we don't see anything like that with our black hole, Sagittarius A star. And there's other things. It's a lot smaller. And so I think myself, I didn't expect them to actually look that similar at all. I expected us to see distinctly different structure. And when we didn't, it was it's very interesting. And I think it says something important about the nature of these two black holes and how similar they are.
Right. And I think that's something that maybe seems counterintuitive to people. The idea of black holes as we understand them, where nothing can escape, but the idea that something can still be almost like ejected from them. How does that work?
Yeah, that's actually one of the really interesting things, or I think misconceptions is, yes, black holes, once you pass something called the event horizon, nothing can escape. You're destined to be inside the black hole forever. However, as matter and hot gas or plasma falls into the black hole, it kind of winds around the black hole in such a way that these big, powerful jets appear. And these are actually what power some of the brightest objects in the sky. A common term is called quasars. And yeah, exactly. And these are the brightest things we observe in the night sky. So black holes are, people think of them as dark dark things, but they're actually incredibly bright.
So the magnetic field structure that a black hole has, and that's where I guess we see some similarities between these two we've been able to observe. So what role or purpose, I guess, does that magnetic field play?
It plays a huge role in what we see and how these jets form. So a lot of the light we see comes from electrons kind of orbiting around these magnetic field lines, and this is actually the light we see. So these magnetic fields are basically directly responsible for what we see, and they also play extremely important roles on the what we call accretion, or how matter falls into the black hole. They really change the dynamics of the system and the overall appearance of the images. And this is actually one of the key takeaways from this most recent paper, is that Sagittarius A star is similar to M87 in that it's a black hole that has so much magnetic field kind of falling into it that it saturates it. And we have something that's called a magnetically arrested disk, or MAD, a mad black hole.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you think how wild it is to have gone from, in relatively short order, you know, the sort of what was a theoretical concept of black holes to, like, hey, look, here's a picture of one. Where do we go from here? What's the next step in better understanding these?
So I think this is really just the beginning. This is really the first time we've looked at two black holes up close, and they look very, very similar, but we've really kind of just started to see the surface. Some of the next things are, is we've only released data from 2017 and really recently 2018, but we actually have three or four years of data still to go and still to analyze. And this data is a lot higher quality. We have more telescopes, and more telescopes mean we can see dimmer features. So instead of having a pretty flat looking image, we can kind of make a high dynamic range image. And on top of that, there's plans to add a large number of new dishes, both to the ground and to space, to kind of make a really high resolution image where we can actually potentially see things like the jet of the black hole directly.
Oh, wow. Well, that will be exciting for sure. We'll leave it there for now. Paul, really appreciate you making some time for us here today. Thanks so much for this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All the best. Take care. That's Dr. Paul Tita. He's with the Center for Astrophysics at Harvard University, former Calgarian, grew up in the city here. He was a core member of this project team. It contributed to the paper that was published this week. So pretty big breakthrough when it comes to studying black holes. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. You can email me, Rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.